Reed?
Hi. Good morning, members of the board, regional board staff. My name is Reed Sato. I'm with the Office of Enforcement at the State Water Resources Control Board. And I want to thank you for the opportunity today to present some information to you on the newly adopted water quality enforcement and supplemental environmental project policies. As you may know, that the existing water quality enforcement policy was adopted in February of 2002. And it was contemplated at the time that the state board would review its water quality enforcement policy approximately every 5 years. And so we started a review of the policy in 2007. We had numerous staff workshops and state board workshops, and we finally came to the adoption of the new water quality enforcement policy in November 17th of 2009. That policy is not official yet because it has to be adopted by the Office of Administrative Law, and that approval process is in process. With regard to the Supplemental Environmental Project Policy, it started off as part of the revision to the Water Quality Enforcement Policy. For a variety of reasons, it was segregated from that policy. It was adopted in February of 2009. It has been approved by the Office of Administrative Law. So as of September 2009, that is an active policy addressing the interest of the water boards. So let me first start with the water quality enforcement policy. So what are our goals? The goals there were basically to, one, increase consistency, accountability, and transparency. And I know many of our policies kind of have these ideals. And I think as we get into a discussion of the policies, you'll see how we really took these concepts very seriously and tried to integrate these concepts into what we try to change in the existing policy. It's a policy statement, not guidance. If you look at the existing 2002 water quality enforcement policy, it's huge. It's huge because there's a lot of informational items, there's a lot of guidance, there's a variety of things that are not germane specifically to a policy. The water board decided that it wanted to have a much more prescriptive policy, so many more shalls, very few shoulds, and so it's reflected in the document. It's a much shorter and truncated document as a result as compared to the 2002 version. And finally, the focus of the water quality enforcement policy is on enforcement. So unlike the existing 2002 policy, we're talking about what the water board should do once we detect violations of water quality laws. Not much discussion anymore about compliance assistance, inspections, which would be kind of compliance assurance. So this is a document primarily designed to address violations. So here is a slide indicating the significantly revised sections of the enforcement policy. You can see that there are quite a few areas that we either amended or added wholesale, and I'll go through each of them. So the first section that we added to the policy was something on facilities serving small communities. And you know, having said that we're going to deal with the issues primarily dealing with violations, this is the one part of the policy that is slightly the exception, because we wanted to be consistent with the work that we'd done on the small community wastewater strategy, and we wanted to recognize the fact that small communities with financial hardship, you know, had special needs when it came to addressing water quality issues. And so there was an emphasis, again, on try to use informal enforcement with these types of facilities, recognizing the financial hardship issues, that we would try to go for compliance assistance as a first step before we initiated formal enforcement action. And where we did want to, or we did finally have a need to initiate enforcement action, that it would be timely, specifically with regard to like things like mandatory minimum penalties. We wanted to make sure that we didn't have things like mandatory minimum penalties build up so they were too great a burden to those small communities. So those are the kind of policy statements that we had with regard to those small communities. And certainly feel free to interrupt me at any point in time if you have a question. The next area that we wanted to concentrate on was prioritizing enforcement for discretionary enforcement activities. In other words, in the existing policy, We do have a prioritization scheme in that we list out what types of violations should be considered priorities for the water boards. However, almost everything that is a violation in our existing policy is designated a priority. So hence, we really had no priorities in the existing water quality enforcement policy. So what we decided to come up with is a framework for prioritizing violations, and we assigned them three classes. And that we established these classes based upon criteria on threat to human health, water quality, or integrity of the regulatory program. And, you know, within each of those kind of categories, we have subsets. Let me just move to that. So you can see with regard to class one, class two, and class three, you go from immediate substantial threat, moderate to indirect threats for class two, and then minor threats for class three. So that's that kind of gradation. So why do we do that? I mean, obviously, we have very limited resources in the water board world, and we want to make sure that the kinds of violations that we pursue are really those that pose the most serious threat to human health, water quality, or our regulatory programs. But at the same time, we also wanted to provide an explanation to the public and the regulated community that if we weren't taking enforcement actions, but we were recording violations for those facilities, we would be able to tell people why we weren't able to take certain enforcement actions against some violations. So for example, you know, if in our enforcement reports, we tend to put out statistics like, you know, we have 10,000 violations we detected in 1 year, but 5,000 we weren't able to get to. And previously, we didn't have the ability to really, you know, explain to the public what those 5,000 violations were that we weren't able to get to. We're hoping with this kind of prioritization system, we will at least be able to explain to the public that the ones we can't get to are those that are actually have the lowest priority, the lowest threats based upon our criteria. After we characterize the violations, the idea is that we would then look at the characteristics of the discharger themselves to decide whether or not a formal enforcement action is warranted and what priority we should give to that discharger for a formal enforcement action. With regard to prioritization, we also talk about more regular enforcement prioritization activities amongst the regional boards and the state boards, where we would more regularly meet and talk about what facilities and what types of actions we need to take on a regular basis. And we also expect that both the state board and each of the regional boards will announce on an annual basis where their general enforcement priorities are for a given year. And finally, this is something that hopefully will help your staff. The state board intends to try to create some kind of algorithm that will allow for the automatic prioritization of violations by 2012. And this is not something that I'm responsible for, so I can't really explain how that algorithm is supposed to work, but is out of the Division of Water Quality. A new section of the Water Board Enforcement Policy deals with state water board enforcement action. A number of groups believe that the statute had been passed that would allow the state board to take enforcement action in areas that previously had been reserved to the regional boards. And so we identified areas and situations in which the state board might take enforcement action in lieu of the regional boards. And that would be with regard to situations like petitions, if we want to enforce statewide or multi-regional general permits, where requested by the regional board, and I think that's really mostly where the state board is going to find itself taking these actions, as we have in the past. Pretty much we've taken actions where the regional board enforcement staff has said, you know, we don't have the horsepower, we don't have the resources to take on a particular case, can you help us take on that case? And when we've done that, we've usually brought it before that region's regional board itself for resolution with the cooperation of the staff. But we do all the legwork and all the horsepower work. And then other times we've had situations where a regional board has said, look, we would like to give you this case and please take it before your state board. And we've taken it before the state board, which otherwise would be a regional board case. In other situations where the regional board is unable to take actions, that might be in a situation where a regional board for a long period of time has no quorum, so it can't act effectively, where a regional board hasn't taken action on a class one priority violation, or where the executive director believes that it's necessary and appropriate. But like I said, even though this is part of our policy, my feeling, based upon what we've done in the past, is that this is not going to be a real change from what we've been doing previously. So monetary assessments in administrative civil liabilities, discretionary civil liabilities. This is probably the area of the enforcement policy that has created the most controversy and the most concern on the part of both the regional board enforcement staff, stakeholders, myself, everybody. It's an interesting thing to try to take on. What we tried to do is to, well, let me first start about the goals. So we wanted to try to come up with a process that we would be able to use statewide that would try to better ensure fair and consistent liability amounts. So when the idea would be an ACL proceeding in Region 1 would kind of go through the same kind of steps as an ACL proceeding in Region 9, given similar types of factual situations and similar types of problems. The other goal of the ACLs were to make sure that we eliminated any economic benefit or competitive advantage obtained from noncompliance. One of the statutes already says that that's one of the goals, 13 through 85. State board's policy is now that this elimination of economic advantage from noncompliance is a goal in any enforcement ACL. And we wanted to talk about how penalties should have relationship to the statutory factors, that is the gravity of the violation, harm to beneficial uses, and integrity of the regulatory programs, fairly similar to the issues that we talked about in terms of prioritizing enforcement. And then, you know, it's important to talk about deterring future violations. I mean, that's the whole goal of enforcement, is to deter future violations. And we emphasize that this deterrence should go to both the violator, the one who specifically we're dealing with the ACL, and to the discharger community as a whole, that discharger may be part of. So what we have come up with is a 10-step process by which we would evaluate discretionary administrative civil liability matters. And I'm not going to go through those 10 steps because we've been doing it for your enforcement staff. We've done it for the attorneys in the Office of Chief Counsel. But suffice to say, it is a kind of what we consider to be a regular and rational process whereby all of the statutory factors would be evaluated, and then at the end of that process there would be an ACL amount that would be arrived at and to be adopted either as a recommendation by the regional board enforcement staff to you folks, or if the board were to deviate from the recommendation that the enforcement staff wanted to make, the steps that you would have to take in order to come up with an administrative civil liability using those same factors. So as you recall, we are talking about consistency and transparency as one of the goals of the enforcement policy. So this process is designed to be transparent. In other words, it requires us to show our work as to how we analyze the statutory factors in terms of coming up with an administrative civil liability. It's consistent in the sense that we are at least trying to get all of the regional boards to use the same rationale, the same methodology. So, with regard to the standard of the review, I mean, whatever determination is made or finally adopted by a regional board, that adopted ACL amount would not be disturbed by the state board unless there was an abuse of discretion, there was an error of law, or a material mistake of fact. That's the regular review standard already, but we just wanted to emphasize again that, you know, we're basically going to defer, for the most part, to the determinations by the regional boards as to the ACL amounts, provided they follow the policy. Now, you can imagine that there was some concern, as I indicated before, there was some concern on the part of a number of people as to how this process would work. And so what the state board asked us to do, and I see there's a typo in my slide here, but the state board has asked the Office of Enforcement to track the implementation of the administrative civil liability process and report back to it in 2 years to see whether or not we've encountered any problems in having this much more transparent process and consistent process being used by all the regional boards. You know, are we getting the kinds of administrative civil liability determinations that we might otherwise expect? You know, what I wanted to say was that I think what the state board is doing here by adopting this kind of approach is that it's saying, look, to the discharger community and to the public, You know, you're not going to see penalties anymore based upon, you know, gut instincts or, you know, somebody in the regulatory side saying, you know, it's an art to try to come up with the appropriate civil penalty and, you know, trust me, on the I've had a lot of experience doing it. This is the appropriate way to do it. We want to make it a little bit more fair, a little bit more transparent, and hopefully more rational for the public and the regulated community. Mandatory minimum penalties. Currently, the water policy indicates that we should be bringing all of our mandatory minimum penalties within 7 months of detection, and that just hasn't happened. And as your board has probably had experience trying to catch up with a backlog of mandatory minimum penalties, some regions have many, many thousands of MMPs that they still have not been able to address. But in any case, I think with the input of the executive officer here, we decided on targeting an 18-month time frame for issuance. Now, this is one of the areas where this is a should, not a shall, because we don't want to allow for a discharger to come up and say, look, if you didn't do it within 18 months, we have no liability for the mandatory minimum penalty. So this is a directive. It also indicates that when we're dealing with a small community, we should try to expedite our enforcement action, or when the matter is greater than $30,000. I mean, I don't know how the Hillsburg situation came up, but there was a lot of cases when we started trying to clean out the backlogs where we started addressing penalties in the hundreds of thousands, the 300s of thousands. It was a big hit for some of the folks, and we don't think that that's appropriate to let those things build up, if at all possible. We've got policy statements defining what a discharge monitoring report are in certain circumstances. This probably doesn't affect you folks very much, but in one region, certain reporting violations were building up because of a certain interpretation that regional enforcement staff was using. We clarified that in situations where, let's say there was a permit would require a report of discharge, whether or not a discharge was happening or not, it would just say, you know, tell us on a quarterly basis whether you're having a discharge or not. People were not providing those quarterly reports. Those are still violations of the permit, but as according to this new policy, those would not be considered violations for the triggering of mandatory minimum penalties. And as you can imagine, a 30-day, when mandatory minimum penalties build up for every failed report after 30 days, it adds up. So that's not going to be an issue anymore if this policy is adopted.
Is it all reports or just, does that apply to reports where that we rely on to know the district? Can you clarify that? Sometimes we rely on reporting to know whether a discharge is occurring.
Well, yeah, I mean, as I said, to the extent that the permit requires a report to tell me whether a discharge has occurred or not occurred, and hopefully I'm answering your question, Samantha. You know, we had said that those can still be treated as violations of the permit, but the mandatory minimum penalty statute has a very specific way of defining what is subject to a mandatory minimum penalty of $3,000. And in that circumstance, we don't think that they would need to pay a mandatory minimum penalty. Second situation, maybe this is what you're talking about, we have a discharge, but no monitoring occurred. We developed, in this policy, describes how that kind of situation can be addressed in the mandatory minimum penalty scheme as well. So, mandatory minimum penalties for POTW serving a small community. Now, previously, the determinations as to whether or not a facility was a POTW serving a small community, that determination was made by the State Water Board. This policy delegates that authority down to you folks in the regional board to make these determinations, particularly for facilities that are financed or served, paid for, but with residential fees. So if you determine that something is a small community based upon these criteria, and it has financial hardship based upon these criteria, then they qualify for consideration for a compliance project in lieu of having to pay mandatory minimum penalties.
There's no place in California with an unemployment rate of less than 10%.
And so this slide also identifies that as well. But There are still some situations in which somebody has argued. Oh, sorry.
Excuse me, Ms. Soto. Back to the previous slide. An unemployment rate 10% or more?
Correct.
Everything in California meets it currently.
Well, then if you know, one of the disputes is why base this problem on the definition of small community? Why not just look at financial hardship? So far, the legislature has not seen fit to do that. So the test in the law is that you have to have both a small community, either defined as county or, you know, a population of less than 10,000, or this financial hardship. So you have to have both. So it may be that, you know, you'll find yourselves with people coming to you and they're saying, you know, we meet these tests, and then you can decide that they in fact do meet those tests.
Okay. Thank you.
Now, there are going to be situations in which somebody is going to argue for small community standards, financial hardship, that are not a facility that depends on residential fees, something like school districts, community colleges. That determination as to whether or not those types of facilities would qualify for small community treatment would just still be retained by the state board. So compliance projects. So this clarifies that the use of compliance projects, that is projects where you allow somebody not to pay a penalty and instead spend the money to get themselves into compliance, those are going to be used only where authorized by statute, and currently where the statute authorizes this is in the mandatory minimum penalty context. So in other situations where there is perhaps a discretionary administrative civil liability sought to be imposed, the policy says that, you know, to the extent that penalties are warranted, those penalties should be imposed and that compliance projects would not be utilized in those situations. And so some other information regarding compliance projects is that, you know, since we're now limiting the use of compliance projects just to situations which address mandatory minimum penalties, we bring in the mandatory minimum penalty restrictions. So they're designed to bring the discharger back to compliance within 5 years. We include requirements now, or custom, and these really are in the form of guidance, about where you can use compliance projects, where the implementation of the compliance project has already begun prior to the assessment of the MMP. There was some concern that, you know, some people have started a project and they would not be able to get credit for the work that they've done for that particular project. We provide some information about that. Finally, and this is new, we want people to report to us on what they're doing for those people who do compliance projects. You know, one of the concerns we always have is people are doing these things that they promise to do, but we don't really have a good handle on what exactly they're doing, what the progress is that they've made. So we're requiring that for projects that last longer than a year, you know, we provide both annual reporting and, for shorter ones, quarterly reporting. And then finally, upon the completion of a compliance project, we'd like a final report detailing the expenditures and the goals that are achieved. Enhanced compliance actions. So some enforcement staff have said, look, you know, I understand that you don't want us to be able to use compliance projects in settlement of some cases, but how about where we want to have some facility do something beyond, above and beyond compliance? And we said that that seems to be fine, that we would have restrictions of no greater than 50% in terms of the use of those kinds of projects, but that the penalty that would otherwise be imposed on these facilities have to be greater than the economic benefit that would otherwise be enjoyed as a result of the violation. And let me give you an example of where this kind of enhanced compliance project has been implemented in other cases. Some folks in settling underground storage tank violation cases said, look, what if we were to double line all of our tank systems, or double line all of our pipelines, even though those are not otherwise required by law? And people have said, okay, that type of enhanced compliance project is something that we would be willing to trade for penalties. So finally, violation and enforcement data. You know, enforcement data is very important to the water boards. We've really tried to, you know, be a much more data-focused organization and making decisions based upon data, not anecdotes. So we want people to enter violation data quickly. So this is just mostly for your staff. With regard to enforcement actions, too, we want to be able to track the response of a discharger to the enforcement action, whether it's formal or informal. You know, we want the water boards and the staff to get credit for the good work that they do. And if calling up somebody causes somebody to come back into compliance, we want to be able to note that down in our data system. And I think we now that's something now in the policy, and that's something we've created the opportunity to do within our data systems. And finally, with regard to public notice, it confirms that we have public comment periods prior to settlements of administrative civil liability matters, but it now requires simply that the posting of and the notice for public comment be on the water board's websites, that we no longer have to go to the expense of newspaper publication. And then we have, you know, enhanced enforcement reporting and performance measures. The performance measures are something that we've always been putting in all of our annual enforcement reports. So the enforcement measures are things that should be familiar to your staff, at least, in terms of what we are looking for, what we are looking to measure. And then we just identify all the legislatively mandated and elective enforcement reports. So I'm going to move off of the water quality enforcement policy and now turn to the issues regarding supplemental environmental projects. And as I mentioned, this policy was adopted in February of 2009, approved by the Office of Administrative Law in 2009, so it is policy of the water boards. You know, and let's make sure we understand, too, you know, supplemental environmental projects are a special kind of entity. They aren't just any environmental project. They are designed to be things that a discharger can use to settle civil liability payments by the performance of an environmentally beneficial project that they are otherwise not legally obligated to perform. So the not otherwise legally obligated to perform is an important thing for us to remember here. So the goal of our policy was, under the existing 2002 version of the policy, there are very few restrictions on the use of supplemental environmental projects to resolve discretionary administrative civil liability cases. And so there was a feeling that we needed, as a result of a number of comments that we got from outside folks, to try to put more specificity on the use of supplemental environmental projects. So we still want to be able to use them, but we want to make sure that a reasonable amount of money still goes to the state authorized statutory accounts established by the legislature, the Clean Water Abatement Account and the Waste Discharge Permit Fund. From enforcement actions. We want to require greater accountability for those engaged in supplemental environmental projects. You know, we found in some of our research that sometimes we would have a discharger give money to a third party, for example, to do some, you know, presumably on paper, very worthwhile project, but there was we never had any assurance that that good project was actually implemented by that third party. So we wanted to make sure that we had accountability for those kinds of things. And finally, we wanted to address the Legislative Analyst Office concerns regarding the use of supplemental environmental projects by the state water board, by the regional water boards. Yes, sir.
Quick question. When you say supplemental environmental projects, I'm looking at as it's the way you described it. If I'm understanding it correctly, that wouldn't necessarily be a project that would bring the discharger into a compliance issue.
Correct. I mean, it
would be like an additional project and not really an enhancement of an existing project, but something added on.
Correct.
Is that
correct?
For example, reading that correctly?
Sure. I mean, there's a whole variety of supplemental environmental projects that I could use as an example, but the idea would be that this is a project that somebody would do that, as I said, once again, they're not legally obligated to do, but that you folks or your staff thinks is worthwhile would be enough an enhancement to the environment that is worth trading off what otherwise would be penalties for to have this type of project.
It's not a response to a compliance issue.
It's not, no, definitely, because that would be something they were legally obligated to perform anyway.
Right,
so it's not a response to a compliance issue.
I just wanted to make sure I understood that fully. Thank you.
Sure. So we want to address the Legislative Analyst Office's concerns regarding SEPs. And this was their concerns. They said that the use of SEPs reduced funding available for statewide projects. And I think by statewide projects, they were referring to the fact that they were concerned about the fact that any money that went to a supplemental environmental project was money that was not otherwise going to the cleanup and abatement account or the waste discharge fund or the funds that would be used to fund projects of statewide importance or statewide interest. They were concerned that the regions regularly permitted SEPs in excess of 50% of the total monetary value of the assessed liability. They felt that the State Water Board should have a role in SEP fiscal oversight. They wanted SEP data to be publicly available. And they were particularly concerned about the use of trust funds to hold funds for future SEPs in a particular region. And I don't know whether this region was one of the regions that did that, but there was a couple of regions that would set aside, a certain percentage out of their administrative civil liability actions and just put it into a fund and say, well, we'll use this for some future project. But the project wasn't specified at the time. That was something the LAO was very concerned about, and that is something that has been addressed by our policy. So let me summarize the revisions that we made. First of all, we limited the amount of the SEP to 50% after repayment of enforcement costs relative to the overall monetary assessment. And let me say that this limitation applies only to discretionary civil liability matters. You're just dealing with a case with Healdsburg, and they're talking about resolution of a mandatory minimum penalty. And the mandatory minimum penalty statute provides for a different kind of split between the penalty amount and the SEP amount. So we have to keep that in mind. This only applies to discretionary administrative civil liabilities. And when it says after repayment of the enforcement costs, let me just give you a quick example. So let's say we have an administrative civil liability for $100,000, and the enforcement cost for that case, this is part of a settlement, so the enforcement cost of that case is, let's say, $20,000. So before you decide what the cap is on the SEP amount, you would have to take out that $20,000 from the total, so you have $80,000. $80,000 divided by 50%, so 40%, $40,000 would be the cap on that particular SEP. Absent compelling justification, and we'll talk about what factors permit or qualify for a compelling justification determination. It prevents the creation of SEP accounts managed independently of the state board without express approval by the state board. There's a process now set up with the state board's Division of Administrative Services to allow for that if anybody were to propose that. But I mean, I shouldn't say allow for that, but to consider that in case anybody were to propose that. And it provides that SEPs can and should be audited so that we have requirements for that. The cost of water board oversight, if any, of the SEP is not included in the value of the SEP unless expressly approved by the water board. So once again, let's say somebody says to you, we want to propose to you a SEP that's worth $40,000. But the board staff says, well, if you accept that SEP of $40,000, that's the actual work part of the project. We will incur an additional oversight cost to make sure that the project is being implemented properly. Let's say that's $5,000. That $5,000 would not be considered to be part of the value of the SEP unless you, the board members, decide that you want to include that. So it is a caution to people not to do that, but you certainly have the discretion to decide that that's how you want to direct your staff and whether that you want to absorb those costs as part of the acceptance of a SEP. We want to make sure that the dischargers otherwise are required to pay for the SEP oversight. Whenever we accept a SEP, we don't want to forget the fact that there are real and actual costs to the boards in overseeing that type of work, and especially very complicated ones. And so we want to make sure that the dischargers are obligated to pay for those oversight costs. And finally, it requires that the steps be fully completed before the discharger satisfies the obligation. Seems somewhat of an obvious concept, but you know, in the past, what has happened is that we've approved steps, like I said, sometimes payments to third parties who are going to do good works for us, and at the moment in time that somebody has paid that money to the third party, they have been relieved of any further obligations without knowing whether or not that project has ever been properly implemented by that third party. The new policy says that the discharger who agrees to do the SEP or who funds the SEP is only going to be able to be relieved of that obligation once the project that is promised is actually and fully completed. So just a few more slides on the policy. We've refined the list of acceptable SEPs to emphasize the nexus requirements and to promote SEPs that enhance compliance or remedy adverse impacts from the violations. By nexus, it means that we want to have a relationship between the violations that are being addressed by the enforcement action and the kind of environmental project that is being proposed to be addressed. And you know, it's kind of hard. I don't have a really good example in my mind, but you know, so certainly, for example, if somebody is violating effluent limitations in a particular watershed, a good nexus would be if there were some kind of environmental improvement projects placed in that same watershed, not you know, in a completely different area or dealing with problems that are wholly unrelated to the kind of violations that we were trying to address. It also recreates annual reporting obligations for the water boards regarding the status of SEPs. We expect now that the project proponents will now provide a report of their status to the state board. That would be the Division of Financial Assistance. And then every March, they are going to publish a listing and the status of what has gone on with accepted supplemental environmental projects that the water boards have approved. Just you know, more of trying to be transparent and trying to inform the public about what we're doing with those kinds of projects. So what is the criteria for evaluating a SEP in excess of 50%? So when this policy was first proposed to the State Water Board, the idea was that if there was going to be a project approved in excess of 50%, that this would be a decision made by the State Water Board. At that board meeting, the state board decided that it would not make that decision, that it would delegate that decision-making to the director of the Office of Enforcement, which currently is me. So these are the criteria that I've come up with to help guide your staff if they ever want to try to propose a project for greater than 50%. And, you know, it's in your materials. I won't read you each of the kinds of things, but it's, you know, it's not intended to be an exhaustive list of the things that we would consider, but it certainly gives you an idea of the kinds of things that we want to consider. And finally, at the very end, you know, we wanted to make sure that we would consider any particular argument raised by the regional staff to justify a SEP. So, you know, this is not designed to really close off the discussion. We don't know that we know everything about what the needs are for your particular region, and we want to be open to the idea that there may be a project out there that really warrants special consideration and is so compelling that it should be funded beyond the 50% cap. So with that, that will conclude my presentation on both of these policies. Thank you very much for your time, and I'm looking forward personally to appearing before you and all of the attorneys in the Office of Enforcement appearing before you and advocating for certain types of enforcement outcomes. Thank you.
Thank you, Reed. Any board member questions?
I just had one. How does this relate to your non-point source programs in California, and what are the enforcement policies regarding waivers if someone violates a waiver condition?
This policy is intended to apply to enforcement actions taken to address those types of issues as well.
Okay.
So, for example, if you are going to assess a discretionary administrative civil liability for a violation of a waiver, we designed the policy to try to address those situations as well.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Massey.
Thank you, Mr. Soto, for a very nice presentation. My own area is in small systems, and with the exception of about 8 systems in Region 1, everything falls in that 10,000 or less, so we got a whole bunch of them. Walk me through CP, SEP, both discretionary and mandatory for small systems only in terms of make these distinctions for us, if you would, please.
Well, to the extent that a facility is serving a small community, a small disadvantaged community, so let's say it meets those criteria that I laid out, mm-hmm. and somebody comes to you and says, we meet these criteria, and you decide that they, in fact, because that authority has now been delegated to this board to make that decision, you can, in the context of a mandatory minimum penalty case, decide that that facility can satisfy its administrative civil liability obligations through a compliance project. So they can not pay any penalty money to the claim and abatement account, but all of that money can be directed towards, what you would do is suspend the penalty for that facility, and all the money would then, you would say, you can, as long as you provide that same money for the implementation of a compliance project, you know, those liabilities will be permanently suspended. If you don't, then, you know, it's a suspended penalty. So if for some reason they didn't do that, then the penalty would come back in and be applied to them. So that's in the mandatory minimum penalty context. In the discretionary liability context, the use of a compliance project would not be available. So the question is whether or not your enforcement staff would suggest to you that, you know, penalties are the way to go with a facility that may not be able to pay you penalties, because, you know, the ability to pay is certainly one factor that we in the policy have the boards carefully considering and evaluating. Let's say they decide that administrative civil liability is really not the best way to get compliance. You have other enforcement tools available to you to use that are, you know, created by statute, claim and abatement orders, cease and desist orders, time schedule orders with you know, stipulated penalties. That may be a better tool for you in those circumstances. So I don't know if that answers your question.
I guess what I'm looking at is a change in the overall, which is to make it more transparent and more consistent. But that also loads the gun for small systems, because frequently small system hardship is a two-edged sword. It is both a method employed or a ploy to get out of things. At the same time, it is a very real issue. If you look at the anything under 10,000 in the North State, I'm absolutely convinced will meet the criteria of economically disadvantaged, the 10% rule, and that's probably true, I would guess, for small systems. That's going to be around 75% of the time. It's just the nature of small systems and that have been historically attached to raw resources. We're going to meet those, and they're going to, I mean, I can tell you that sitting right where you are sitting, you will see small systems come in and say, but you got to give me a CP because I'm in this category and you want consistency and transparency and so forth. Some of them, and we don't want to do that. We have seen them too many times.
Well, I can certainly tell you that, you know, with regard to any decision to allow somebody to do a compliance project, even under the mandatory minimum penalty scheme, that discretion, it's not an automatic thing. Simply because they meet these criteria doesn't mean that you automatically have to allow them to do that. You have the discretion to say, you know, something less than 100% can be used for the compliance project. Nothing can be used for the compliance project because you have no history of making an effort to try to comply with the law. The discretion rests with your board as to how you want to ultimately use the authority that's given to you under 13385K.
Okay. One last question. 50% on the SEP less the expense that we incur in the process, correct?
Right. That's for discretionary administrative civil liability.
With the with mandatory minimums, do we get anything at all out of that? Or can we give it all away?
No. Under mandatory minimum penalties, there is a limit of 50% except for the first 15,000. So let me, I think the formula they used with regard to the Healdsburg case is instructive, because I think what happens is that you can allow the first 15,000 to be used for a supplemental environmental project, and then beyond 15,000, it's 50% of beyond that. So that's why you'll see a slightly greater than 50% in, you know, projects above 15,000.
I was thinking in terms of compliance projects.
No, in terms of compliance projects, I mean, for those small communities, there isn't a limit. You can do 100% for
a compliance
project.
We can give it all
away. You can.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Chair. Reed, thank you also for coming today. It is very instructive to, you know, hear how this is formulated. I agree with Mr. Massey that small communities in my short tenure on this board struggle mightily to run plants and accept effluent out of the end of a pipe, treat it, meet our requirements, and get it all done, given all the things in between that could happen. One question, though, is is there a response? Of course, if you have somebody that's completely noncompliant, a discharger that's completely noncompliant, then they put themselves in the position of being subject to ACLs and mandatory minimum penalties. Is there, though, some type of consideration, and I didn't see it here, of a response factor from an incident, not an MMP where you're simply exceeding an effluent discharge requirement, but is there discussion in the levying of mandatory minimum penalties and or enforcement based on the response factor to, say, incident-type things?
I appreciate your concern. With regard to mandatory minimum penalties, there isn't any discretion. I mean, the legislature passed that law because they, from what I understand, because they were concerned about the lack of response by the water boards to certain types of violations. So they made it very prescriptive for us in terms of how we are able to address those types of violations. With regard to discretionary liabilities, you know, you have much more leeway. The response is a fact. You know, I didn't go through all of the 10 steps in our administrative civil liability assessment, but one of the steps that we would go through and evaluate is the responsiveness of the discharger. So that is, in fact, something that you would consider and decide to assign a value to that particular responsiveness for the purpose of coming up with an overall penalty.
And on a related subject, I could see where you could use enforcement, and in fact, you know, it is a fact out there that enforcement can change behavior, right? It is a tool. And from that standpoint, looking at it, you know, enforcement, I think, from my standpoint, I have to say I would rather have these small community systems, because that's really what we're dealing with in our region, in to correct the problem. A SEP doesn't necessarily do that always, and I think that's the intent, to keep it within a watershed, keep a nexus to the problem that originated the enforcement. But I would just voice that from my standpoint, I would rather, instead of seeing a check written by a discharger, and I know that there's mandatory minimum requirements, and I know that there's I understand that certainly that happens, that a check has to be written, but I would just say that my favor is to have that money and resource put into correcting a problem that originated the enforcement to begin with, as long as it is warranted, given that it's not somebody with intent that caused a problem or a discharge or a violation, that simply because of the economics of our region, that it feels like a takeaway from those communities when really what they need is to use that funding to correct that problem.
Right, and I believe that you have the statutory tools at your disposal, that should you your board decide to go that direction, you know, there are ways of doing that.
Thanks.
Great, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, I see our item 5 Healdsburg team has returned. I would like to ask Mr. Rivera, Mr. Rodriguez et al. To